Protect your boats and recreational vehicles with FBP RV and Marine antifreeze. It has burst-proof protection down to negative 50 degrees, keeping you protected against freezing temperatures. Keep your winter worry-free with FBP ready-to-use RV and Marine antifreeze now at Menards. Visit us in-store or on Menards.com and shop our great selection of automotive products.
Save big money at Menards.
Find other great podcasts like this one at podmoth.network.
Yo, what is up, my friends? Welcome to What the French Toast, your favorite podcast on the internet that leaves you asking yourself the question, what the French toast did I just listen to? I'm Skylar.
I'm Megan. And just a heads up, side effects of this podcast may include goosebumps, jaw drops, and uncontrollable what the French toast moments.
Look, we get it, okay? You're tired of the same old podcasts.
You want weird, but in like a fun way, not my cousin just joined a cult weird.
Right. So if true crime keeps you glued to the couch.
And if conspiracies make you suspicious of your Alexa.
Or if ghosts and cryptids sound like really solid Friday night plans.
Then congrats, you found your podcast.
We're just two best friends, and we probably laugh way too hard while also diving into the bizarre, the chilling, and honestly, the straight-up unexplainable.
But we don't promise answers, just chaos and good vibes.
New episodes drop every single Thursday wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Come and get weird with us.
Hey, what are you up to?
Oh, hi. I'm listening to this awesome podcast.
Ooh, I love finding awesome new podcasts. What is it about?
Well, it's about a bunch of things. Sometimes history, sometimes hauntings, sometimes it's spooky, and sometimes it's funny, but it's always interesting.
Ooh, okay, that sounds great. What's special about it?
Well, each week, Celine picks a topic and reads it, and... Matt creates a pairing of a treat and a drink to go with this peculiar tale.
And they
talk about it and they joke about it.
Hold on.
And sometimes they have guests and have even more fun.
Wait a second.
What?
That's our podcast.
Yeah, you're right.
Why are you listening to our podcast?
Well, you know, we're heading into the long dark of winter, and that can make some people feel kind of isolated, and listening to peculiar pairings is a great way to feel like you're hanging out with good friends at the push of a button.
Well, that actually sounds really nice. Kind of sounds like everyone should be listening to peculiar pairings.
You know, I couldn't agree more.
So if this sounds like it's piqued your interest, you should search Peculiar Pairings Podcast on your favorite podcasting platform today.
Yeah, we're everywhere. Come check it out.
Find us. We're there.
Welcome back, everybody. Thank you for joining us again. How are you today, Declan?
I'm good. I'm excited for today's episode.
Yes, so am I. What story are you going to tell us today?
I'm going to talk about Lake... I'm going to fuck this pronunciation up. Lake Pignor?
Pignor.
P-E-I-G-N-E-U-R in Louisiana. But there was some interest... Some weird thing...
Okay.
Not some weird things. A weird thing happened there.
Okay. I don't
what story
know
do you
that
have
I've
for
heard
us?
Of it. So... I'm looking forward to that. I have a serial killer story. But I should say serial killers. Because it's not just one.
The Clinton
which is,
family?
allegedly. No, it's from the early 70s, and we don't very often get stories about multiple serial killers, but this essentially was. So we'll get into it. The drink that I have to go with it is called The Accomplice. The ingredients are supervine sugar, which is optional if you want to put it around the rim of your cocktail glass. 3 large strawberries sliced, 1/2 ounce of simple syrup, 2 ounces of vodka, 1/2 ounce of lemon juice, and 1 to 2 ounces of champagne to taste. The steps are to wet the rim of the cocktail glass with a slice of lemon, then coat the rim of the glass in sugar, if you're doing that. If you're skipping that, then just go straight to this part. Add your strawberries and simple syrup to a cocktail shaker. Muddle the strawberries, then add vodka, lemon juice, and ice. Shake well and strain into your cocktail glass and top with champagne. I used 1 ounce of champagne because I'm not a huge champagne liker. So let's
skip the sugar rim because I feel like this is going to be sweet enough as it is.
Well, I think it also depends on how much champagne you use. Because champagne, I feel is kind of bitter. Oh, did you? Yeah. I'm not a fan of it.
So. If you get like a dessert champagne, it can be kind of sweet. I think that's what I
true.
Got. I truthfully don't know what all the wine words mean.
Neither do I.
Frittato and all right. fucking Malinois.
Malinois's a dog.
I know, but that's what wine names sound like to me.
Okay. Well, let's give this a try and see.
Okay.
I'm glad I stuck at 1 ounce of champagne. My strawberries were pretty small. It's very pink, but it's not as strawberry forward as I would like. But my strawberries were, I bought them 2 days ago and they were already moldy. So I had to just take what I could get out of the container, even though they've been sitting in the fridge.
When you buy strawberries, do you keep them in the strawberry box?
I did this time because I bought them and then we left town. And so I just shoved them in the fridge and they got moldy in 2 days.
I had to stop buying berries for a while because I was having that issue too. But I found if you put them in a bowl with water and just a little bit of white vinegar, it kills a lot of the mold on the outside, and then you just rinse them off so they don't taste like vinegar anymore and they last twice as long.
I did that the last time I bought a bunch of berries and it was great. This time I didn't because I thought I'll just get right to them. Fruit
going bad here. Yeah. Something about the valley, like all the humidity and warmth and shit.
For sure.
Like I bought some peaches that they were not even close to ripe. They were still pretty solid. I left them in the bag on the counter for 2 days and I came back on the next, like the third day, and there was just a puddle of peach juice in the bag. I'm like, how the fuck did you go from not ripe to spoiled so quickly? Right.
I bet that happens to your avocados up there too. Because avocados go from not ripe to overripe in like the blink of an eye.
Yeah. Safeway, for some reason, is really bad about putting unripe produce out. Like the bananas, they'll put green bananas out and they're good for 2 days. And it's like, you got to wait till they're not green anymore. You have 2 days to eat 6 bananas and then fucking they're instantly brown.
Well, right, bananas are gross.
Bitching for me. Let's hear your story.
Okay. I mentioned there's a couple of killers in this story. We're going to start with Dean Corll. He was born on December 24th, 1939 in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He was the oldest child to Mary Robinson and Arnold Corll. The couple would have another son a few years later. As a child, Corll was described as shy and serious. He was sensitive about any kind of criticism and often seemed to care greatly about other people. Apparently, that stopped when he was an adult. Spoiler alert, but Corll spent time growing up in Tennessee and Texas when his parents moved around. His parents had an on-again, off-again marriage, getting divorced, then remarrying each other again, and then finally getting divorced in 1953. So they were together and divorced and together and then divorced again. And I guess the second one finally took because then they were done. Even though the marriage had ended, the Corll brothers still remained in contact with their father. Kroll's mother and her second husband started a candy business that became a family affair. Everyone helped make the candy and distribute it. When that marriage ended, his mother started another candy business and her sons ran the company.
When was this again?
This was in the 60s.
Okay. So I'm thinking like nowadays you couldn't just start a candy company.
Start a candy company? No.
Yeah.
This was the early 60s. The crimes occurred in the early 70s. So we'll get there. In 1964, Kroll was drafted into the military, which went well for him, even though he didn't like being in the military, which is surprising that he did well in it. In 1965, he was given an honorable discharge after he requested a hardship release, claiming that he was needed to work at the family candy shop. Apparently, you could do that back then, which I didn't know, but they were like, oh, you're fine. You can just get out. And they went, okay. Strange to me. The candy business was located across the street from an elementary school, and Kroll was known to give free candy to kids, especially to teenage
boys.
That's
like
boys.
Being a heroin dealer outside of a methadone clinic. That's crazy.
Right. And I mean, back in the 60s, people probably didn't think too much about it. They were like, oh, this nice guy. Now, if that happened, I think people would be lighting red flags on fire and screaming
homemade
from the top
candy
of a mountain.
Being given out outside of a school. That'd throw a lot of red flags nowadays.
By an adult man who's just giving away free candy to kids. No.
Oh, God.
I don't think that would fly.
Is this a story where the Halloween candy thing came from? Okay.
It is not.
Okay.
The fact that he was giving away the candy led to him being nicknamed the Candyman and the Pied Piper. Kroll liked to surround himself with kids. The Pied Piper, I think it has something to do with like the story, the old, I don't know if it was a legend or wives' tale or whatever you want to call it. The Pied Piper, like, I think it was supposed to be in Ireland, played a pipe and led the snakes off the island or something. I don't know.
The story of the Pied Piper is about a devastating consequences of breaking a promise, with theories suggesting it reflects his real historical events involving the disappearance and death of 130 children in the town in Hamelin, Germany, around 1284.
Oh, okay. Well,
popularized by the Brothers Grimm.
Okay.
That makes his nickname sound a lot darker then.
Well, yes. I think he got the nickname before the crimes happened, but he definitely was doing some shady shenanigans.
That's weird. We might have to cover this Pied Piper story.
Okay.
130 children disappeared from one town on June 24th, 1284.
All at one time?
Yeah. I think, I mean,
Is it a real story? Or is it?
I don't know. That's
the Brothers Grimm I associate with like fairy tales.
So it. Theory suggests it reflects a real historical event involving the disappearance, while the popular version was popularized by the Brothers Grimm. So maybe they turned this story into, or this event into like a creepy kid story. I don't know. We'll have to do more research on that. Let us know if you're interested.
Kids,
send us a
kids stories
DM or a comment.
Can be creepy. Back to our lovely Candyman, yes. Pied Piper guy. He liked to surround himself with kids, even installing a pool table at the candy factory so that employees and kids could hang out and socialize, which is so normal for adults to hang out and socialize with kids that are in elementary school.
Okay, but in the 60s, I think it was a lot different. I think there was like...
It was.
People in the neighborhood who were like, oh, let's all go hang out at Maggie's house or something.
I guess.
I don't know. But I wasn't alive in the 60s, so I don't know. But I feel like they had more of like a community-based...
Your age currently, could you imagine hanging out and playing pool with a 12-year-old?
No, I was invited to a 2-year-old's birthday party this weekend and I refused.
Imagine if today was the day your idea changed someone's life. Imagine if you could help someone pay for college, help your community build a new playground, or help a child make it to that dream competition. With GoFundMe, it's all possible. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform trusted by over 190 million people. Every week, ordinary people meet their goals and do extraordinary things. Your ideas matter. GoFundMe isn't just for emergencies. Want to raise money for your kid's soccer team or raise funds for a small business, a creative project, or event? GoFundMe helps you turn ideas into reality. And help adds up. Fundraisers you start for someone else raise up to 5 times more. So think right now, who could use your help? Change rarely comes from waiting. It comes from someone deciding, today I'll start. Don't wait for someone else to bring change. Today, start your fundraiser in just minutes at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com to start your fundraiser. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
I don't blame you.
Sorry if she's listening. I'm sure the party was
It's okay. I get it. When Coral was 28, he befriended a young neighborhood boy, David Brooks. The boy was one of many youngsters who would hang out at the candy company, and he was a 12-year-old sixth grader. Again, should not be hanging out at a candy company with adults, but hindsight's 2020. So,
was this before child labor laws? Was this a job interview?
No. Well, it was... I don't want to be gross, but it was a kind of job interview.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Brooks was born February 12, 1955. We're going to do a little talking about him now. He had one older brother and would later have a half-sister. His parents divorced when he was young, and his mother eventually moved to Louisiana. For many years, Brooks would often visit his father, who remained in Houston. When Brooks got in trouble with the law in Louisiana for stealing some stuff, he moved back to Houston to live with his father. Basically, the law enforcement in Louisiana caught him red-handed and said, maybe you should get out of here. And so he went back to Texas and lived with his dad. Rather than filing charges and having more things illegal happen surrounding this kid, there they sent him to Texas, and turns out he did some illegal stuff there too. But some illegal stuff also happened to him. His relationship with his dad wasn't very good, and he would often stay at Coral's house, our candyman. The candy company would eventually close in the late 60s. At this time, Coral was also working as an electrician, and he continued on with that job.
I think it's weird, too. Like, this must have been before a lot of health and food safety guidelines, because you can't just run a candy company out of your house.
Right.
Like, just garage beer? Like...
You
can't sell garage beer. You could give it to people, but you get in trouble if you sell it.
But you have to have special licensing to have a kitchen that is food grade worthy if you're going to be selling it to people. And so back then they probably were like, oh, I made candy in my garage. And they're like, that's cool. Sounds
good
to me.
You're allowed a certain amount of sawdust shavings.
Yeah, exactly. Nobody's inspecting that shit.
Yeah.
They're just like, great, sugar. Wonderful. Coral had maintained his friendship with Brooks and would often give the teenager money, and their relationship eventually turned into a sexual one. No shocker.
How old
to
was Candyman
anyone.
Again?
Believe he was like mid 20s at this point.
Okay.
Yeah. It's gross. It's gross. There are some really gross details in this whole story that I have condensed down to about a sentence because it's nasty to cover all of the individual details because I feel like it's just gratuitous to talk about like, well, this happened to this victim and yeah. I don't want to talk about it to that extent. And I don't think it's necessary. Since Brooks spent a lot of time at Coral's apartment, it wasn't unusual for him to let himself in. One day in 1970, Brooks walked into something more than he expected. On that day, Coral had two boys tied to his bed, and he was angry that Brooks interrupted him. Okay. Yes, you have a concerned look on your face.
I am very concerned.
As you should.
That's
yes,
very
because
concerning.
There are two boys tied to a bed. That's not something I said boys okay. for a reason.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's ugh.
I'm just mentally preparing right now just for the next
yeah,
sentence.
Yeah, it's there's a lot. There's a like I said, there's a lot of bad stuff that happened, but I condensed it all fairly well, I think. He asked Coral, Coral asked Brooks for his silence. Coral was mad that Brooks showed up, interrupted his nonsense.
Torture.
And said, please don't tell anyone. If you don't tell anyone, I'll buy you a car. Which he did.
A 12-year-old buying a 12-year-old a car?
No, mid-20s bought... Brooks, I believe at this time he was
like
15.
After. Oh, okay.
This
so later
they became
in their relationship,
friends.
I guess.
Yes. Their okay. quote unquote friendship started when Brooks was 12 and
okay,
continued.
So ugh,
he's 3 years older. It's still gross. He's like yeah. 15 years old. Coral bought him a 1969 Corvette.
Back then, it was probably $350 or something.
Probably. Coral later Damn. Explained the boys that had been tied to his bed were being sold to a pornography ring in California. And that's why they were there. Which...
Okay.
Not
I
good.
Would just like to say that at 15 years old, a Corvette could buy my silence too, I think. A 15-year-old driving a Corvette. Ooh.
It's gonna get worse and it's gonna get gross.
Or at least gather and evidence and take him down so we can't take the Corvette back because he's in jail.
Yeah. Sorry. Unfortunately, he didn't go there. Realizing that Brooks could be bought off, it wasn't long before Coral asked for his help in abducting boys. Cause who better than to get boys? Is another young boy. Coral offered Brooks $200 for every boy that he could lure to the apartment and asked him to target boys that would not likely be missed by their family or friends or...
This is Jeffrey Epstein's story in
yes,
the 60s.
Yes, but with boys.
Yeah.
Not young girls.
I'm sure he had both. Fucking freak.
Probably. $200 in today's money is about $1,600. So he was saying, I will pay you $1,600 for every young boy that you bring here. Which begs the question, how much money was this guy making as an electrician? Because that's
some
dough.
I'm sure it was the other activities he was doing.
Probably. Probably.
Human trafficking has a lot of, it involves a lot of money.
Yes.
So
where there is some question,
just the fucking bottom line, like
there's some question as to whether or not he was fully trafficking them or if it was just photographs.
But
or,
he was working with the child porn ring, so like maybe you'll get
that
into
was his
it.
Story.
You'll see. We'll see.
But it's going.
Just keep going.
Yep. This arrangement worked well for both Coral and Brooks because Coral wanted victims and Brooks wanted money. As any teenager, girl, boy, doesn't matter. You know, people in general want money. Brooks lured several boys to the apartment over the next 10 months. The boys were all restrained, sexually assaulted, and then killed.
Fuck.
They were not trafficked. They were murdered. Although Brooks claimed to not have participated in the assaults and murder, he did admit to helping Coral with burying the bodies. In October 1971, Brooks befriended another teenager named Elmer Henley. Henley was born May 9th, 1956 in Houston. He was the oldest of four sons, and as a child, he was a good student. Based on his family's religious ties, he once considered being a preacher. The relationship between his parents wasn't great, and his father was physically abusive to both his wife and his children. As an adolescent, Henley pointed a gun at his father to stop him from assaulting the mother, which is probably going to mess you up pretty good, I would think.
Yeah.
His parents got divorced in 1970 when Henley was 14 years old. Things started going downhill for Henley at that time. He was working multiple jobs and selling drugs to help his mom pay with bills, and his school started suffering. Prior to this, he was a good kid, good at school. After this, kind of went off the rails.
I don't mean to derail this again, but when did Brooks catch him with those boys? Do you know what year that was?
I believe it was 1970.
Okay, because Gacy, John Wayne Gacy, he was implicated in another child porn ring that was doing similar things. And so I wonder if these two were connected with the same.
Possibly. Some of the research that I found definitely indicated that the pornography ring could have been very real, but maybe he was taking these pictures before he was killing these poor kids because there was some discussion about a big amount of child porn that was tied back to him. But at that point, all the cards had fallen out of that house that we're going to get to that. So I think at that point law enforcement was like, well, what's done is done. We can't do anything else at this point.
Okay.
The two boys, Brooks and Henley, would often skip school together. And eventually Brooks introduced Coral to Henley. Originally, the plan may have been that Henley was going to be another one of Coral's victims, but it soon turned into Henley becoming another accomplice. Coral offered Henley the same amount of $200 to bring boys to his home, claiming that the boys would be sold into white slavery. Coral claimed he belonged to a syndicate of organized human traffickers, and he actually called it the Syndicate, which seems like something that people would say now, so it kind of surprises me that that was a thing in the early 70s, but I guess a crime group can have the name the Syndicate no matter what century you're in. It took a few months before Henley decided to participate, but ultimately he decided to do so because his family needed the money. Henley soon learned the fate of the boys he brought to the apartment was not human trafficking, but Coral was killing them. Often all three of them would participate in the abduction and then disposal of the bodies, but sometimes it was just Henley and Coral working together. Brooks did note that Henley was getting more involved in the torture of some of the victims and also participating in some of the murders. Brooks maintains that he did not kill any of these victims, that he just helped acquire them and then dispose of them. But the murder part, he just was in the room but didn't participate. That's his story. This arrangement went on for two more years until 1973. In August 1973, Henley brought one of his friends, 20-year-old Timothy Curley, to Coral's apartment. Brooks was not present on the day that this happened. Henley and Curley sniffed paint fumes and drank alcohol for several hours before leaving around midnight, promising to come back. They drove back to Henley's neighborhood and encountered one of his friends, 15-year-old Rhonda Williams. She had just had a fight with her dad and was planning on running away from home. Henley convinced her to come back to Coral's house with them. Coral was not happy that Henley brought back a girl to the house because he had intended for Curley, the 20-year-old guy friend, to be his next victim. And now all of a sudden there's a girl there and he doesn't like girls. He's only into boys or young men. The three teens spent the next few hours drinking and doing drugs.
Imagine if today was the day your idea changed someone's life. Imagine if you could help someone pay for college, help your community build a new playground, or help a child make it to that dream competition. With GoFundMe, it's all possible. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform trusted by over 190 million people. Every week, ordinary people meet their goals and do extraordinary things. Your ideas matter. GoFundMe isn't just for emergencies. Want to raise money for your kid's soccer team or raise funds for a small business, a creative project, or event? GoFundMe helps you turn ideas into reality. And help adds up. Fundraisers you start for someone else raise up to 5 times more. So think right now, who could use your help? Change rarely comes from waiting. It comes from someone deciding, today I'll start. Don't wait for someone else to bring change. Today, start your fundraiser in just minutes at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com to start your fundraiser. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Until they all passed out. Henley woke up gagged and Coral was handcuffing him. His friends were on the ground next to him, also gagged and bound. Coral started kicking Williams, telling her to wake up. Coral had a hunting knife and a handgun. He threatened to kill all of them, but Henley said that he would help with the torture and killing of his friends if Coral would let him live.
God.
I can't.
That's awful. That's just horrific.
It's terrible. I mean, I get he's thinking, well, I'm going to save myself.
I mean, shit, once you get the knife, then you could just attack him.
Yes, and maybe that's what one of his ideas were.
I mean,
right.
If you get a weapon, if he gives you a weapon to kill, then might as well just kill him or try. Like, if it's your friend.
Exactly. Core released Henley with his agreement and then restrained both Curley and Williams to his bed. Coral ordered Henley to cut off Williams' clothes and assault her before killing her. He started cutting her clothes, but she questioned him, asking, is this really happening? And are you going to do something to stop it? Which apparently caused him to change his mind. Because he then grabbed the gun that Coral had set on the table while he was assaulting Curley and told Coral to stop. Coral advanced on Henley, saying that Henley wouldn't shoot him. He's like, you're not going to really shoot me. At which point, Henley shot him.
Let's go. There we get that. Okay. I'm glad that happened.
Yes. Shot him a total of 6 times.
Emptied the whole fucking clip on him.
Basically. After some deliberation, Henley called the police and reported the killing. Police took Henley into custody, and he detailed the events of that morning and the night before. He admitted to shooting Coral and explained it was done in self-defense. Williams and Curley corroborated Henley's story. saying, yeah, this guy was going to kill us and he was going after us and he was doing bad things. And our friend stopped him. Henley also recounted how for nearly 3 years he had been helping Coral to abduct, torture, and kill young men and boys. Henley also told about Brooks's involvement in the process. Henley told police he knew three different locations where numerous bodies had been buried because he had been helping in some of those burials.
Oh, man. That is rough.
Yeah. Both Henley and Brooks assisted officers in identifying locations of the burials. Most of the victims were buried in a boat shed rented by Coral. Several other victims were buried at Lake Sam Rayburn and High Island Beach, which is around the Houston area. Police began excavations at all three locations. In total, 29 victims were found, but police believed Coral had more.
Damn.
There were some discrepancies between the number of victims Henley reported would be there, but police essentially just stopped digging. They were like, this is enough, I guess. Oh. Also, there were a few additional bones found, and that those bones were like the arm bones that didn't seem to be related to another victim. And the coroners said, okay, well, that's clearly another victim, but we have no way of identifying who those bones, because it's just arm bones. And I believe 27 victims were found, but then two other victims without the full bodies essentially were found. So the total is 29. Both Henley and Brooks signed confessions to their participation in Coral's activities. Although Brooks denied that he personally participated in any of the murders, he did state that he was present at some of them. Brooks was charged with 4 counts of murder, and Henley was charged with 6. Even though both boys had signed confessions, they each pleaded not guilty at their arraignments. Henley was not charged with Coral's murder, as it had been ruled self-defense. Both boys were eventually convicted and sentenced to life in prison. Brooks died in 2020 from complications associated with COVID. He was 65 years old. Henley is still alive and has applied for parole several times, but it's been denied each time. He is next available to apply for parole in October 2025, next month, at the age of 69, but he does not believe he will ever receive parole for his crimes and will remain in prison until he dies, which is probably a good assumption, I would think. I don't think anybody wants to let this guy out.
Now that, like, I'm thinking about it, I'm pretty sure they were involved in this way, way larger child porn ring that a dude got arrested for and was running from prison, and it was like a magazine type deal. So, like, you would sponsor kids, and by sponsoring them, yeah, so... Maybe we'll talk about that on another episode. But it's really dark.
There's a documentary about this that focuses more on Henley's story. I believe it's called The Serial Killer's Apprentice. It's in my sources. The Serial Killer's Apprentice documentary. It's on Hulu. Hulu? HBO. HBO. And they do talk about the porn ring and the link that there is. And then also some of the other written sources talk about how there are pictures of Coral's deceased victims. There are pictures of those kids in the child porn that was located in California. Like thousands and thousands and thousands of pictures. And a couple of those boys are in some of those pictures prior to Coral murdering them.
That's got to be a shitty job, having to look through those and identify people. Like, oh my God.
Oh, Yeah.
There's like, I hear some horror stories from people who just like, they control the content on like Facebook and stuff, and they have to like go through reports and like.
That's
I think
terrible.
There was one of those on
job.
Other people's lives, that podcast.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It was tough, but.
I think I heard that one and it. Oh.
Yeah. Okay. It, let's talk about this weird
crave
lake.
Things. Yuck.
Let's talk about lake. Something better. This is an interesting story.
Something bizarre and not brutal, hopefully.
So Lake Pinoir sits on Iberia Parish in Louisiana near the little town of Del Camber, and it's on the northern edge of Vermilion Bay. It's a curious body of water, shallow and freshwater before 1980. We'll get into why it's no longer freshwater. It's ringed with cypress trees and used for fishing, boating, and occasional small industry. But below that, the surface of the lake lies something older and stranger than the boats. Salts and domes of rock that speak to millions of years of geological pressure. Louisiana's Gulf Coast is dotted with salt domes, columns of evaporated salt that have moved upwards through younger sediments, pushing up domes of land and creating traps for oil and gas to accumulate. Jefferson Island is one of such domes, an upthrust of rock salt that for decades held both a working underground salt mine and above people and industry that lived near the lake and stuff. The salt mine operated by Diamond Crystal, which later became part of a larger salt companies, had been operating for many decades and had many levels and extensive tunnels carved out beneath the island and other portions of the lake. The mine operators left pillars of salt to support the ceilings in part of the caverns, as it's common practice in room and pillar salt mining. So.
What? There's pillars holding the ceiling up? Pillars of salt?
I mean, yeah.
That seems unstable.
Well, it's fairly stable, but we'll get into why it wasn't, I guess. But
was not. Okay.
So there's three things layered on top of one another. The lake, the island, and salt dome below. And decades of human activity, miners below mining salt, oil men above looking for oil, because the way it's built, there was like an oil deposit above the salt mines. Or in the salt mines. I'm not exactly sure which. But there was oil near the salt. So
Each
activity was kind of compartmentalized to different companies. There was obviously the oil company, and then there was the salt miners who were digging there for years and years. The salt mine was owned and operated by the Diamond Crystal Salt Company. The Jefferson Island mine had been operating since the early 20th century. And over the years had experienced typical mining hazards like roof falls, fires, and maintenance incidents. But it was dangerous working in a mine back then anyways. So you could kind of expect those things to happen. It had become an established operation with dozens of mines and tunnels, multiple working levels, some hundreds to over 1,000 feet below the surface. Historical record shows that the mine had experienced at least one fatal roof fall in during earlier decades, as well as other mining incidents typical of deep underground operations. So it was just like other types of mines. Like, it's a dangerous working environment. There's going to be injuries.
Right.
I think this was before OSHA existed, but
probably mining safety was something that wasn't really paid attention to for a long time.
Above the lake in November 1980, an oil exploration operation was taking place. The rig on the lake was a platform contracted by Texaco, and they were to conduct exploratory drilling for hydrocarbons near the salt dome. On that day, the crew was drilling a 14-inch exploratory hole from a barge-mounted rig on the lake bed. They had permission to drill in this area. They had all the permits and stuff they needed. The surface coordinate arrangements and mine maps were supposed to keep the two activities from colliding, but there were subtle and fatal mismatches in the map references. So, someone who was in charge of making the maps fucked something up. So the long established salt mining below and oil exploration above, each company had technical expertise in the field, but when engineering plans and maps didn't line up, the results were catastrophic. It was November 20th, 1980, around mid-morning. The Texaco drilling crew noticed their drill string had become stuck deep below the lake floor. 2.5 hours earlier, their 14-inch drill assembly had apparently seized roughly 1,200 feet, a depth that, as was later determined, put the drill dangerously close to the mine's workings. The crew tried multiple remedies, but the bit would not come free. There were loud pops and groaning sounds below the rig. The platform began to shift around. Crewmen scrambled for safety. Their first sign above water was that the platform was tilting. Then the platform slid and began to go under. The drill had punched through an old abandoned portion of the Jefferson Island mine. And once the rock salt was breached, the path was open for lake water to rush into the mine with terrifying force. So imagine there's this, you're in a really big lake and there's a salt mine about 1,200 feet below that this oil company accidentally pierced through because their maps were wrong. And so all that fresh water is dissolving all the salt in the mine and rushing in, because at 1,200 feet, that's so much weight above the pressure. Salt mine.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. That's so terrifying.
Yikes.
The fresh water pouring into the salt mine is effectively like pouring water into Swiss cheese. The water dissolves salt pillars, makes any previous holes larger, and destabilizes the remaining structure that was planned out but when they were mining the salt.
Imagine if today was the day your idea changed someone's life. Imagine if you could help someone pay for college, help your community build a new playground, or help a child make it to that dream competition. With GoFundMe, it's all possible. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 190 million people. Every week, ordinary people meet their goals and do extraordinary things. Your ideas matter. GoFundMe isn't just for emergencies. Want to raise money for your kid's soccer team or raise funds for a small business, a creative project, or event? GoFundMe helps you turn ideas into reality. And help adds up. Fundraisers you start for someone else raise up to 5 times more. So think right now, who could use your help? Change rarely comes from waiting. It comes from someone deciding, today I'll start. Don't wait for someone else to bring change. Today, start your fundraiser in just minutes at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com to start your fundraiser. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Within minutes, the lake began to form a whirlpool that would suck barges, boats, trees, and even part of the island into the center.
What?
Yeah. So just imagine so much water is being drained, like a Pirates of the Caribbean whirlpool is just sucking in boats and shit.
Holy crap. That is wild. I did not expect that.
As the lake drained into the mine, the pressure changes were violent. Air inside the mine chambers had to escape somewhere, and it erupted through the mine's shafts and openings as blasts of compressed air. Oh my God, that's just so scary. Just a giant force of wind coming at you. The sheer force of moving water and air made the scene apocalyptic. A 5-story oil derrick vanishing into the lake, pulling multiple barges under, trees uprooted and swallowed as the lake emptied into the salt caverns below. And mind you, this is like 5 stories of a salt mine.
Yeah. Holy. Geez.
So there was a canal connected to the lake, and the force of the water being sucked in reversed the flow of the canal. So
okay.
This is how just right. like how powerful this shit was. I want to see like a movie of this.
Wow. Yeah, me too.
The direction reversal pulled salty water from the Gulf of Mexico into the canal and subsequently into what remained of the lake bed. This reversal produced a sudden short-lived waterfall and measured about 150 feet. So this is a big waterfall that just came from the canal because so much water was sucked down. Yeah, it was so powerful that many of the barges popped back up to the surface days later. So after the boat had been sucked down, it just popped back up, started floating again, and tons of debris from all the oil rigs and barges were floating over to the edge of the lake and stuff, washing up on people's property. Despite the scale of the destruction and the violence of the flood, there were no human deaths attributed to the event. The mine was uninhabited at the time. No one was down there. 55 workers That's were good. Inside the Jefferson Island mine, but not where it had flooded. And once they heard the sounds and the sudden flow, thanks to quick thinking, the mine's electrician decided a torrent and sounded an alarm. And through the training, everyone evacuated through the mine's single elevator and exited in an orderly fashion, all surviving.
Wow.
Yeah. On the drilling platform, seven crew members fled the rig before it disappeared into the whirlpool. A fisherman off the lake made it safely to shore during the chaos, and everyone was saved.
Could you imagine being the fisherman? You're just out there on your boat minding your own damn like, business.
A little.
You're like, doo-doo-doo, I'm going to catch me some trout
and you
or
just see,
bass
like, an entire
or something.
Oil rig get sucked into the water.
And then he just goes,
whoop. Oh my God.
I would be, that's crazy.
That's fucking terrifying.
Wow.
Yeah. So all that just because the maps didn't line up. It's amazing that no
maps
one died,
important.
Though.
Yeah.
In the weeks and the months after the event, the physical and legal cleanup began. Barges were salvaged and the lake slowly refilled, but the water was no longer the same. Salinity rose as Gulf water reversed into the basin and mixed with what was left, and along with the dissolving salt mines that the lake was now filling. But all the aquatic life and local ecology that had been freshwater either adapted or were lost. So... because it turns from brackish water. And,
A
lot of freshwater fish can't survive in salt water. So
not in salty. No.
But yeah, that's the story of Lake Pinure. And
I'm sorry, but salt pillars are not stable.
They were stable until they were covered in water and dissolved. I mean, well, if you're thinking it's like, any hard rock, like it,
but
it was up
granular.
There for like over 100 years,
right?
Over 100 years. Well, no, because a salt lamp isn't granule; it's like a rock. That's what salt comes from. So, like
that,
it's not just like,
but it's dissolvable. Salt. It's dissolvable,
and especially under
water,
a lake. You'd think that
salt,
you would,
yes.
Eventually a drop would come through or something, but the whole lake came through in this instance. So
I mean, same thing could have happened if there had been an earthquake and there was a crack in the basin of the lake.
Yeah. I don't it's scary. Scary that everyone's it's amazing that everyone survived, I should say.
That like, is fantastic.
The most impressive
part. I did not expect that.
Yeah.
Yikes.
Well, do you have a chaser for us?
I do have a chaser. My chaser is back in March. We did an episode on the Crater Lake Lodge, and we just went and spent the night there last night.
Yeah, I saw some pictures that you sent me. It looks fun.
Yes.
It's always fun going up to Crater Lake, though.
I think the only wildlife we saw were a couple of birds. That was it. We didn't see any chipmunks, which is unusual because there's usually chipmunks running everywhere up there. I didn't see a chipmunk. I didn't see any ground squirrels, nothing. Couple of birds. That was it. We didn't see any ghosts.
I want to try the lake tour where they put you on the little boat and take you out to Wizard Hat or whatever it's called.
Wizard Island. That is closed for the next 3 years.
Why?
They're doing some type of renovation and rehabilitation on the trail that goes down from the rim down to the base of the lake.
It's sketchy.
They are fixing it. I don't know what they're doing, but it's going to take them 3 years. And so the trail is closed. It was open. It was supposed to be closed this summer, but there was some kind of a delay, so it didn't get closed until like a week and a half ago, which...
My friends tried to get me to jump in there, and I couldn't do it. That shit's way too cold. No, it's like 40 degrees, isn't it?
I believe it was 60-something degrees. When I did the episode back in March, I think the average temperature was like 60 degrees of the lake water because it's runoff, it's melted snow. There's no inlets or anything, but
according to Google, it says about 55 degrees on the surface and 38 at the bottom.
Ooh. Well, it's deep.
It is very deep.
It's very deep.
I still wasn't jumping. I don't do open water. You know that. I'm not doing.
Right. We stayed in the lodge, which is supposed to be haunted, and our the lady checking us in. One second. The lady at the lodge that checked us in said that the elevator that was working, she said whenever she rides in it, she gets a very creepy feeling. But she's never seen anything or encountered. There's supposed to be a Chinese man that occupies the elevator. And she said the third floor, there have been reports of a little girl. So we walked around the lodge a lot on all four floors.
The Chinese ghost in the elevator is Wong on so many levels.
We did not see the Chinese ghost in the elevator. Right, it is. The only weird thing that happened to us was we were climbing the stairs and the stairwell was quiet. It was silent. We were the only people in the stairwell. And we got off, walked up to the third floor. And when we opened the door onto the third floor, we could hear a woman talking in the hallway. She was not in the stairwell. You could hear she was in the hallway. And then the door closed. And when the door slammed shut, she stopped talking. No sound. We sat there for a minute and waited, and we didn't hear a woman talking anymore. We were standing in that hallway for probably 3 minutes just thinking, oh gosh, because we hadn't really seen hardly anybody else or heard anybody else in the hotel part of it. So we were like, it's weird that her talking ended at the same time that door slammed. So I went back into the stairwell to see if I could hear if the noise was coming from the stairwell, and the stairwell was quiet. So that was not anything that I had heard other people talk about when I was doing the research for this, but it was kind of weird.
Because you should have got like a spirit box.
Oh, I don't want to.
Where it like
that
shifts
shit.
From that... radio channels. It's like it cycles through radio channels so quick that if you hear something, it's probably a ghost talking. Oh, we should have got you that. Maybe next time I'm there for a while, we go up there with a spirit box.
It was a really cool looking lodge that had some really interesting features, and it was a nice place. I would stay there again. The food was really good. I didn't know that the lodge had its own restaurant.
It's got decent food.
But
I think it's probably just as good as that Eagle River one. We go. What was that called? Eagle Point. That one that's like a diner overlooking a river.
Oh,
you drive kind of out of town a little bit. They've
Harriman Springs and Rocky Point.
Both. That's what I think.
Rocky Point.
Yeah. They've like
the
similar food
was decent.
Like, it's both pretty good. Like,
yeah,
for being that far out there.
Right.
Yeah.
What's your chaser today?
My chaser is for all the people that like to cook out there. I just started lacto fermenting vegetables. And
oh, yeah.
So if you're not familiar with that, it's basically a salt brine. It's how they used to pickle vegetables before vinegar. Because I'm sure... if you like food, you've probably tried to make your own pickled onions or pickles like with vinegar and salt and sugar and stuff. But this
sometimes
is just a salt brine. And so
I might like that better.
It's full of probiotics because it creates an environment that allows the lactic acid bacteria. Yeah.
Okay.
So what I did, like, I've tried a couple different things. I can't get the pickles down. They always come out mushy for some reason, and I think I'm using the wrong cucumbers. Oh, but
that could be.
I've tried so I've made my own hot sauce, and that was amazing. It was just jalapenos, serranos, garlic, and it came out tasting super sour and funky, like I'd put like lime in it or something and like vinegar.
Oh.
It came out really good. And then
nice.
I did carrots. I just cut like a big carrot into quarters, kind of like you would with like a pickle spear, like, and then put it with garlic, onions, and jalapenos. I let it sit out in a cupboard, for 3 or 4 days, I think. Because I think also with the first pickles that I tried, I let them sit for a week, and maybe that was too long. Because once you put them in the fridge, it kind of slows it down a lot. But
okay,
I took the carrots out about 3 or 4 days after starting the ferment, and they taste exactly like pickles, but they've got like a
nice,
super good
crunch.
Yeah, it's
ooh, I like it.
It tastes so good.
I've
just
been
eating
pickled carrots
like in the morning for probiotics and stuff. And
smart,
yeah, it's really good. I recommend everyone give it a try.
Nice.
It's kind of like a fun little science experiment, but you have to watch a lot of YouTube videos, like I did. Or buy some like weights because you can get botulism.
Yeah.
If you do it wrong. But
yeah, I don't want that.
Yeah.
Well, good job for trying something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know that I would have the guts.
Food hobby. It's something fun to do on like a Sunday. Just make some pickled carrots and then have them throughout the week.
Yeah, that's awesome.
It's a little nice thing to relax to, but I think that brings us to the end of today's episode. Thanks for listening, everybody. Enjoyed hearing.
Yes, thank you for joining us.
I'm
going
to have to look and see if that guy's connected to the ring that I'm thinking of. Because we could do a multi-episode thing about that. Because it's connected to a lot of serial killers like him and Gacy and some other bad people. But let us know if you want to see a story about that. Drop a comment. Send us a DM. Something like that. But
definitely.
Love you, Mom.
All right. Love you, bud. Bye.
Bye.
Hey, friends. Thank you for supporting our podcast. Please share our show with your brutal and bizarre friends. Give us a boozy follow on your favorite podcast platform. If you're feeling extra generous, we'd appreciate a 5-star rating or review as well. But maybe do that sober so all the letters are in the right place.
You can find all our contact information in the show notes. We love hearing from you, and if you're interested in helping us stock the bar for our future boozy episodes, you can find our Patreon link in the show notes as well.
Imagine if today was the day your idea changed someone's life. Imagine if you could help someone pay for college, help your community build a new playground, or help a child make it to that dream competition. With GoFundMe, it's all possible. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform trusted by over 190 million people. Every week, ordinary people meet their goals and do extraordinary things. Your ideas matter. GoFundMe isn't just for emergencies. Want to raise money for your kid's soccer team or raise funds for a small business, a creative project, or event? GoFundMe helps you turn ideas into reality. And help adds up. Fundraisers you start for someone else raise up to 5 times more. So think right now, who could use your help? Change rarely comes from waiting. It comes from someone deciding, today I'll start. Don't wait for someone else to bring change. Today, start your fundraiser in just minutes at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com to start your fundraiser. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.